Accession number 20375, Reel 2.
Built by Reel 2.
Even on the two occasions we were hit, I don't think I felt that I was in any danger. I was never afraid of being killed in the tank. The nearest, I suppose, was when on one occasion I was asked to go down the side of the hill on foot to pick up some supplies. I think it was a rum ration, and I had to run down the hill, down into the valley, to the supply truck that was doing its rounds from one tank to another, because there was no, the tanks weren't side by side like you see on the movies in desert warfare films. We would be on one hill, then you could have a craggy outcrop, and the next tank would be sort of way over, and you might not see them for days. And as I say, I run down this hill, and for no reason at all, because things have been quiet all morning, suddenly several rounds of mortar fire suddenly landed, almost as though somebody was picking me out. It wasn't, it was just one of those things, it was just a stump that had come down, and I run. That's when I was frightened. I managed to get to the bottom of the hill to the ration truck, only to find that everybody was under the truck. And it lasted, I suppose, 15, 20 minutes. And they said, here, grab this, give me the jug of rum. And they legged it out there as fast as they could go, which meant I had to go back up the hill back to the tank. And as I say, walking back up the hill, all the noise and smoke and dust had gone, and I suddenly realised I was shaking. But once I got back to the crew, Bob turned around and says, "Didn't you think of stopping and putting yourself in a hole?" And I said, "No. In fact, I don't think I thought of anything. All I knew was that you told me to go down the hill, and that was all I had, was tunnel vision of get down the hill." And he said, "Yeah, all right." Anyway, we dished the rum out, and then he gave, as one troop, we had to, our supply belonged, sorry, we had to divide it up between the four tanks that represented one troop. And he gave one of the other lads the job of taking it over to them. And it was just after that day that we received a new officer, and he was all bright and shiny and straight out of the box, straight out of Sandhurst. And we were young, but I mean, we'd been in Korea for some while then, and we'd suddenly decided that, not decided, we'd suddenly become aware that we were learning. I think that's what it was. We'd suddenly learnt how to survive. When this character came and reported and took over SHQ troop, SHQ tank, and Bob said that he would learn, he would fall in. And the first morning that we were there, or that he was there, we suddenly realised that he was standing at the back of the tank. There used to be a water tap at the back of the tank where one could drain water for cooking and that sort of thing. And he got a bucket and was filling this bucket up to have a wash. And I think it's the only time I've seen a non-commissioned officer really lose his temper with a commissioned officer. Because he walked up, took this bucket of water off and threw it away. And he turned around and he said, "Do you know what you've just done?" And this young chap, frightfully British, frightfully upper school, and said, "I am going to complete my ablution." Never heard of the word. "I'm going to complete my ablutions." I thought an ablution was a building where you went for a crap. And he said, "Not here." He said, "What you have just done is thrown away all of our tea and drinking water for the next 12 hours. And this young lad's face crumpled. And he turned around and he said, "But how does one keep clean?" And it was only then that I realised that we hadn't been keeping clean in the accepted sense of the word. You had sufficient water to make your tea, and you started by washing with the water in the first instance, using the same water to wash your socks, because that was a big one, keep your feet clean. That, and then cleaning whatever else you needed. Wash, clean your eating utensils, then wash your socks. And in that order is how you divided your water up. And actual bodily washing, I think we only did that during the summer months when we were in a little legal area called Mistletoe Orchard. And we'd been stuck in there for some while. Because for some reason, generals don't tell troopers what's going on. They sort of mention it to officers, and the officer might mention it to a sergeant. But very seldom do they come along and tell the ordinary squaddy on the floor what's going on. And we'd put this barbed wire entanglement all around this area, and it was the first time I'd seen all of the tanks all together. And the word went out that we were going to make a stand, and the idea that this genius upstairs had come up with was that if we got lots and lots and lots of ammunition and buried it in this place and kept it hidden, we could then move forward on an attack, move back and make this place a rear base. We would then have stacks of ammunition to hold up the Chinese when they chased us down this road, which was great. Except that we did all the digging, we buried all these thousands of pounds worth of shells. I mean, a 20-pounder shell is about that high, 2'6". And that's 99% solid brass, which is a lot of money. And we packed all these in this hole. scattered everything to make it look as though nothing had been disturbed. And it was called a box. They'd made this plan, they'd worked it out to the last detail. The only trouble is they hadn't told the Chinese, so they didn't come that way. So when we moved forward, instead of moving back in the same direction that we'd come from, we moved into a totally different direction and left all this stuff behind. So either some little Korean has found a gold mine in brass being buried, or it's still there. And that was in the summer month. There was a small stream which we dammed and made a sort of swimming pool, a swimming hole. And I think that's when we used to keep clean and whatnot. If ever we could get near a river or a stream and the weather was somewhere near warm, that's when we wash all over. In fact, in the whole time I was there, I only visited a mobile bathhouse once. That was the only, I can always remember that. We were divided up in groups, sort of two from one tank, gunner and driver, radio operator and commander, into two groups, so that if the gunner and driver of one tank, then it was the operator and the commander of the second tank, so that if anything happened, you would have a complete crew to make up one tank crew. And that's how it worked when you went down to the bathhouse. And it was the first really good bath. I mean, a bathhouse, it was a truck with a pump fitted and a shower unit on a piece of angle iron, I suppose you'd call it, and they used to pump this water through. It was like a big bowser full of water, which they heated. And then the water used to come heated, it was lukewarm. But lukewarm was good, because at least it was, you were clean at the other end of it. And we came out the other end, a new set of jungle greens, because we were in summer kit, and back up the line. And I think we then discovered that we never felt totally clean. I don't know if I'm getting across to you what I'm trying to say. Although we'd been washed, we still didn't feel clean. Not skin clean, it wasn't the right way for people to live. I think that's what I'm trying to say, is that no one should be made to live in them sort of conditions. We felt again that as tank men, we were better off than the kids that were living in slit trenches. So how they survived, I don't know. But when we came back at the end, we felt dirty. And I think it was because I've been trying to avoid saying this, but it's easy to say I fired so many hundred rounds of ammunition. At no time did I ever feel that I was killing anybody. I watched shells fired, and I watched them follow their arc and I watch them land. But I didn't feel that I was killing anybody. Apart from one occasion where we had got a good view across the valley and we could see the Chinese in their trenches and we could see them actually digging the trenches and we could see the earth coming over the top. And we were told to traverse and aim onto that particular lit. And I remember putting that shell in the breech, firing it, and watching it, and actually watching it all the way and landing in that slit trench. And for some reason, I still don't know why, that particular shell stuck in my mind, God, I've killed them. But then, like everything else, I hadn't. Because as soon as the dust and muck cleared away, this little Chinaman popped out of this slit trench and literally brushed himself down and carried on digging. And it was only, I suppose, a couple of days later before we finally took that position. And when we got over there, they had literally dug from the far side of the hill, through the hill, and then made their slit trench to come up where they wanted it. So that when we were firing at the face of the hill, and they were possibly 200-400 yards inside the hill. And we could have sat there for a month and blasted that. It was only when the infantry took it from the sides and round the back that we could trundle on and take it off. And we then discovered just how good the Chinaman was. We'd up and I suppose there was a time when we said to them, we used to look at them as gooks, as chinks, and whatnot. And suddenly, he became the Chinaman. He was not a little laundry man who one American commander said we were going to roll up in a matter of days. He was a hard fighting man who knew his job. And I've watched quite a number of these American History Channel things saying that the Republic of Korea, which the South Koreans, were the weak link in most battle lines. And I don't agree with that. I think the reason that the rocks used to bend or cave in or whatever was because the Chinese threw more troops at them than they did at anybody else. And that's why if a line was going to bust, yes, it was going to be the Republic of Koreans, but that's only because they carried more weight than the rest of us.
Why should they do that? Why should they concentrate on the Korean?
I think it was they probably believed that they were weaker. Plus the fact, although they were kitted with the American most of the equipment was American while we were out there. I think basically it's that they weren't trained. It's great. You can put a man in uniform and you can say you are now a soldier, But if you haven't given him the basic training and you haven't got a cadre of trained officers and NCOs, then with the best will in the world, you cannot make a person a soldier without giving him the basics. And I think that basically what the problem was. What we'd done was we'd gathered the South Koreans and said, right, we've come to help, but you've got to help yourselves. But I don't think we gave them the basic training. We just put them in uniform, give them a gun and said, right, this is your section, hang on to it. Because given the chance, given the opportunity to move forward, they would move forward with the same tenacity that the Chinese and the Republic of Korea, the North Koreans would. And I never felt that the South Korean was as... I felt that he was hard done by in the write-ups that have been since the Korean War. I saw an awful lot of Americans that run away, that came back through the lines. But it's easy to say that it was war is a dirty business. Nobody should fight a war. There is nothing glorious. There is nothing honourable about fighting a war. We've come to the millennium and we still don't know how to settle arguments unless we shoot somebody. And wars are not pretty. They're not glorious. It's just a waste of young, and it's always the young. It's always the cream, and it's always the good blokes that get killed, and I don't know why. Can I stop there for a minute?
Could I ask you about this secondary set? Does that mean to say that you had two wireless sets?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you had a 19 set, and then you had what was called a B set, which was a little auxiliary set. That the 19 set, which I still think. But then I'm old-fashioned. It was an old valve set in a tin box that was bolted to the side of the tank. And I suppose she was, what, 2'6" by about 18 inches by about 2 foot. And there were two dials. They were the biggest cows that they ever invented to tune in, because you had these two dials and two grub screws, and you used to tune them into a set wavelength that had been given to you, and you then had to tighten it up with a penny, it was called a penny screw, hold the dial still, tighten the screw, then the second one, tune that in, and you had on your headset, you used to tune this wheel and it would whistle and you tuned the whistle to its lowest point until it finally vanished, and then tightened the screw. But every time you did that, the cow would whistle the moment you took the screw away. So you'd start all over again. And it's like any other art. Once you've got it off to a tee, you could usually do it. In fact, I suppose like any job, when you learn and it comes to you, you suddenly realise that you don't do it. It sort of clicks in your mind. You hear the whistle, and just when you think it's gone, you wait for that tiny fraction and then do it, and the whistle holds and is gone, and you've suddenly got a set that is tuned in 100%, and that's great. And we did a radio net in Aden, and three of us tuned a 19 set on a Skywave aerial and picked up Bovington in the UK. And that, to me, was probably the best bit of radio equipment that I've seen. I've watched these kids fighting in Desert Storm and whatnot, and they've got all these up-to-date modern radio sets and whatnot with crystals and everything else, and they don't work. But at least if the 19 set radio, as long as the valves were all right, you could guarantee you would get through to somebody. It might not be the person you were looking for, but at least you could talk to somebody and know that that somebody was on your side. And they worked, as I say, they worked right the way through. Well, certainly all the way through Korea. We came out. I remember when we were coming home, we came back down to Britannia Camp, which was just outside Pusan, and we were handing over to the 5th Skins, 5th Inner Skilling Dragoon Guards. And we got the job of cleaning the tanks. Now, we'd been through 2 years of this thing, and apart from basic maintenance, it was just fuel and oil, and check the tracks and whatnot, make sure it was going round in the right direction, and that was maintenance. When we pulled out into Britannia Camp and we started to clean the tanks, mine sprung four oil leaks that would have put any other vehicle off the road. But because of the muck and mud and gunge that had built up over the months on the engine, it must have sealed them, because we spent more time on that fortnight cleaning it up and repairing and getting the Remy into replace seals and whatnot, and yet the tank, she'd been running like a dream all the way back down that road, and we were told to get everything shipshape because we were going to hand them over to the youngsters. And it's, as I said about growing up, I was sitting there and I got the radio out of its case. You, four screws, and you just used to pull it out, and you could see the whole guts of the thing spread out. And I got it out, and I was sitting